Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. Bloody horses' heads and exploding cars, picturesque paisani and wisecracking wise guys, white spats and Tommy guns, Vito Corleone, Tony Soprano and Carmine Falcone. These are the tropes we all recall at the mention of the word mafia. Old world romantic fiction steps in to fill the gaps in our understanding. But as in the recent arrest of Messina Denaro reminded us, the mafia is very much a brutal, evolving, and very, very real organization. My guest today is an award-winning professor at the University of Bath who has devoted her working life to the study of organized crime, especially the Italian mafias. Yes, there are more than one. She is the author of Camorristi, Politicians and Businessmen, and The Invisible Camorra, Neapolitan Crime Families Across Europe, which won the American Society of Criminology's Outstanding Book Award. Welcome to The Bunker, Philia Alam.
Thank you for having me.
Philia, let us begin with an easy one. What is organized crime? How does it differ from disorganized crime, as it were?
So you say it's an easy one. I'm not sure it's very easy in the sense that we have this ongoing debate among academics about what is organized crime, and we just don't agree. We get a sense of what crime is, but we're not really sure what the organized bit means. One way of looking at it is to visualize it in terms of a continuum of different forms of criminality. And at the far end, we might have some kind of group that does some kind of criminality. I don't want to call it gangs, but some kind of youth activity at one end. And then slowly going in the direction, in the other direction, we get more and more organized. So we have organized crime groups that act together. Then we go further down the line where we have crime syndicates, where they're more structured. And then at the far, far end, we have mafias, specialized criminal groups with a certain amount of organization, internal hierarchy to a certain extent, certain rules, use of violence, which the other groups use as well, but here probably in a more kind of systematic and focused manner, but is their relationship with politics. Mafias use politics in order to gain access to profits. And that, if you want, to a certain extent, is the defining element of mafias compared to the other groups, which we can define in various ways.
How do you study criminal organizations? I mean, they are by definition shady and elusive.
Absolutely. It's challenging. My approach has been very much a kind of observation, if I can, but also accessing and trying to talk to people, communities who are affected by criminality. But also in my work on the Italian mafia, I've been fortunate enough to talk to former criminals and to try and capture their insider's perspective. I think we need to combine our understanding, not only using police reports and judicial reports, but also the people involved. Because although, as you said at the beginning, it sounds quite glamorous and quite sexy, actually, it's also very violent. And a lot of people involved have no alternative, you know, to become involved in this form of criminality. So it's a it's complicated to study, but we have to in order to try and perhaps fight it better.
Why is the Italian mafia, or mafias as we will come to discuss, why are they the ones that have captured so much attention?
Italy is an interesting example of, if you want, this phenomena and the way that it has developed through the centuries and its relationship with the state. So when I talk to my students, and I make a difference, if you want, between Italian mafias in Italy and organised crime in the UK or crime syndicates in the UK, the metaphor I use, or the analogy I try and sort of use with them, is to say, whereas in Italy, it's a virus, it's got into our body, yeah, it's in the body politics, in the body of Italy as a country. In other countries, it hasn't got in because that state building process was different. And in Italy, it is very much intertwined, if you want, with the economy, with the political system. And also, you know, if we go to the south of Italy, but also in the north of Italy, you know, it tries to control the territory in a very specific way, which means that it is a fully expansive power system that we can see and that we can feel.
Are they still quite dominant in the states, or have they been overtaken by other syndicates?
So to call them Italian mafias in America, I think, is slightly imprecise, in the sense that what we call La Cosa Nostra, which is, if you want, the American form of Italian organised crime, is a kind of criminality that developed parallel to the development of American capitalism, but at the same time, the arrival of Italian immigrants from Italy. So Lucky Luciano is somebody we refer to frequently. He was an Italian who arrived in America with the American dream, and out of his own socialization and life became involved in this criminality. And he was the one that, in a way, organized the Sicilians. He went back to Sicily, I think, in 1956, if I recall correctly, and got all the locals and said, look, you know, if you want to make money, you've got to get organized. You need a commission, you need an executive, you need rules.
Can I ask you something related to that, sort of tangential? Why is this kind of organized crime always so closely aligned to migrant communities? Why do these organizations always sort of define themselves by their provenance in a way? It's quite nationalistic, isn't it?
I think that's a fair point. At the same time, I think we have to unpack it, because I think with globalization, we, you know, lots of people travel. It's not unusual. I think perhaps the problem is the labels that we give as outsiders to this phenomenon. I think that's one level of analysis of how I think right-wing press have adopted, you know, like the Albanian question at the moment. Well, if we take a closer look at organised crime in the UK, organised crime in the UK is thriving and we're not talking about it. So I think that there is a potentially a political kind of right-wing agenda. And secondly, I also think at the same time, clearly, as a survival strategy outside of your country, when you come to a new country, you're obviously going to look for people who are like you, who talk your language, who, you know, they're the people outside your country that you're going to identify with. And then what we can also see is criminal groups targeting these new immigrant communities. So it's kind of, you know, it is complex.
So we know that there are more than one, even Italian mafia. Messina Denaro, who was recently arrested, which one is he connected to?
So Matteo Messina Denaro was a member and a leader of the Sicilian Cosa Nostra. So the Sicilian Cosa Nostra is based and located in Sicily originally. Mm-hmm. We know about the Neapolitan Camorra because Roberto Saviano has written and done lots of films on it. And we're also talking a lot about the Calabrian Andrangheta, which seems to control a lot of the cocaine trafficking into Europe, whereas mm-hmm. the Sicilian Cosa Nostra has gone quiet on us. The main reason is because it was the organized crime group that developed that terrorist strategy. I don't know whether you recall, in the early 1990s, they were the ones that planned and murdered judges Giovanni Falcone and Paolo Borsellino.
Yes, I remember that. There was a spate of them, yeah.
In 92 and in 93, they also bombed museums in the mainland. After that, they went underground. One of the theses that has been put forward for the reason as to why their terrorist strategy came to an end is that there was a negotiation between members of the, or representatives of the state and Cosa Nostra. And this has also been part of a trial. So there's this kind of shadow, if you want, around Cosa Nostra. What is clear is that they've become more submerged, more hidden, because they've lost, I wouldn't say support, but that confrontation with the state has meant that they weren't able to carry on business as usual.
You see, what you've just said to me implies somehow that their systemic interconnection with sort of politics is so profound that even they operate by a set of common rules.
We have to go back in history a bit to understand the equilibrium that existed in post-war Italy. What I mean by that is that Italy was considered by the Americans and the Vatican as the last resistance point, blocking communism. And that also meant blocking communism in terms of making sure that the Communist Party in Italy didn't come to power. So that entailed, if you want, a kind of complete focus on that, which meant that there was this other area where criminality was kind of tacitly accepted. When the Christian Democrats Party starts to lose power, they then sort of start looking for help and for potential votes from different types of communities, including the mafia that by that time has become quite important. And therefore, we know that there have been kind of relationships between the dominant Christian Democrat Party and the mafias.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Ophelia, the image of the mafia is steeped in machismo. How do women fit into that? Or, for instance, LGBT people?
So this is something that I've been working on recently, and it's really difficult to unpack because I think the first stumbling block is what we see as outsiders. We are being fed and we are given a kind of male lens and a male narrative. So if you have a look, and this isn't just in Italy, this is across the board, even in the UK, people look at crime, they see the men. They don't see the women. The women are considered either as victims, which sometimes they are, but they're not given agency to participate in the criminality, or their power and influence are not necessarily seen. So we're fed a certain way of seeing that, which also reflects in the films and in the TV series that we see, where it's about masculinity, it's about macho ways of life, it's about, you know, very strong image that we associate. And I think that that very much is our construct. We construct that. That's in a way, as a society, what we want to see. So women within that, there are obviously a lot of women who are victims to internal mafia violence within the family or within the grouping. I'm not suggesting that's not the case. Yeah. What I am suggesting is that we still have a tendency to eradicate the agency of those women who are fully engaging with these groups and who buy into the criminal project. And I just want to focus quickly, if I can, on there's one group I've been looking at in Naples where, you're absolutely right, we kind of push this kind of big external macho image, and very much an image that we have in the street, you know, these young men with tattoos, they all have a beard, they all go around on their mopeds. And if we look at that, we think, oh, well, the women aren't there. But if we take a closer look, the women are there. And there's this one particular group in the periphery and suburbs of Naples where, you know, the women are very masculine and they behave like men and they say that they're men. There's one in particular who was shot in front of her two kids like a man. That's how the local press, you know, she was killed like a boss, you know. And she says, they've got an intercept set where she says, I am a man, I'm not a woman, I'm a man boss, right? But then if you go and have a look at her Instagram or her Facebook,
but she also lives her femininity. She is a woman. She kind of embraces her femininity. She's a mother as well. So we've got these kind of different layers of values of, you know, what society inflicts on us or imposes on us as, yeah, we have to be macho, but also the way that kind of women live that. And it's not, I don't think it's necessarily an automatic male space. I think women negotiate space. And so much so that women have a voice, and actually women are better at managing these organized crime groups and these mafias than men are.
It's interesting because I have spent some time in southern Italy and Sicily, and my impression was that while the public sphere was very much a patriarchal structure, the family sphere seemed to me very often to be a matriarchal structure. And I just wonder if mafia structures are, to an extent, family-dominated, how those two things interact.
It's interesting you say this, Alex, because I've just sent off my manuscript last night on Camorra women being able to negotiate and navigate the household, because they are very much in control of that household. There was a very interesting American psychologist who wrote a study back in the 1960s where she identified, she did a lot of tests and identified and said basically women in particular in Naples as matriarchs emasculated their sons, and therefore their sons, in order to be men, macho, virile, they had to affirm their existence in the street with the Camorra. And I thought that was an interesting way of unpacking
that.
To sort of say it's not just men dominate, because that's the image we have, right? Men dominate the public and the private sphere. And I think that the system also projects certain images and certain values, which are, you know, constructed to a certain extent of what we see or what we expect to see. And I think, again, in relation to the police, and again, across the board, not only in Italy, but also in Europe, they kind of project, or they're looking for men. So they only see men, and they don't even think about the women. The women are put to one side and sort of said, look, sorry, you know, we need to get on with this.
A couple of things to wrap this up with. These organizations have been glamorized, I think, by film and television, you know, and not just the Italian mafias with The Godfather and Sopranos, but we now have Narcos and Tokyo Vice. It's an attractive subject for someone writing drama, because there's a lot of drama in it. And I just wonder whether there is a danger that in a sort of time of not belonging, of family structures feeling less strong, of religious structures feeling less strong, whether there is a danger that these organizations offer something to young people that other structures don't, and the sort of phenomenon of baby gangs.
I think you're right. I think that's not only in Italy, but also in the UK, if we talk about county lines. There is something around the state and the state's withdrawal. You know, I often hear that, and I think back to my own childhood about how we used to have youth clubs. We used to have the public space was filled with activities for children and young people to feel a sense of belonging to a community, to feel that they belonged and that they had things to do. Whereas I feel very much in Italy, but also in the UK and in France, where the state withdraws from that space, then other groups can come in, whether it's a baby gang that gives you a sense of identity. You know, you've got no hope, so you're better off just going around on a moped shooting. And the same here. I think the family structure in Italy is stronger than here. I mean, that's one of the conclusions that I came to looking at organized crime in the UK. One of the big differences is that there was still a family unit, perhaps because of the Catholic presence, the presence of the Catholic Church. There was still this kind of family identity. It was weaker, perhaps, but there was still that structure. Whereas here, the state withdrawing its activities or its kind of stimulus to young people, and the family not being a strong structure, we have these kind of young people who are lost and who are then being recruited as runners for county lines. And that, for me, is the scandal in this country, is all those young people who are not being structured or not going to school because the state's not stepping up.
Let's end on a hopeful note. Has any country been exceptionally successful at eradicating this kind of organized crime? Do we have paradigms that we can point to and say, look, it can be done, it can be rooted out?
So first of all, I think what we need to say is that there has to be political will. There has to be an appetite to understand what these criminal organisations do, not only in the street, controlling people's lives or bothering people or imposing themselves on people, but also clearly understanding that these organisations, their ultimate aim is to recycle their dirty cash into the legitimate economy. We have to understand that it's not just about the violence, which is important. You know, we don't want violent groups, but that there's a whole money cycle. And that, you know, it is also about laundering money, buying real estate, buying tourist activities, and that's where they ultimately want to go. So if we don't have the political will to identify those processes, not the just low-hanging fruit, but the real high-end criminal syndicates, then I think we're never going to get anywhere. And that's why, you know, the UK leaving the EU with Brexit, I think, has damaged this country enormously in terms of that, because I would argue that that hasn't helped, that we haven't kind of got that kind of European togetherness of fighting this project together, because we have to fight it together. And at the same time, as I said previously, these groups are really ahead of the times. So what we can see, and this is where we can see that the policing, the French, the Dutch, the Belgium, are really trying to focus on the use of encrypted telephone conversations and encrypted messages and electric e-platforms, because that's where the kind of big crime syndicates are now at.
Right.
What we've got is we've got these high-end drug trafficking groups who are kind of completely off the radar. And we can see that there are some police forces like the French, like the Dutch, who are starting to sort of understand. I mean, obviously, there's a debate around, you know, how far you can infiltrate people's telephones. And that's a debate for another day. But there is this trying to understand where these criminal groups are and where they're undertaking their activities. So law enforcement are trying to address their modern techniques. And I think that, you know, the Italians would say we're behind on that. We're good at, you know, monitoring local groups, we're good at understanding where they are, but ultimately there isn't an ideal. Ultimately, this has to be a collective fight, and for the moment it doesn't really seem to be. It's a very disjointed fight, these different levels, because it's so complicated and so complex.
Dr. Philia Alam, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex.
Remember, there's a new Bunker pretty much every day. So if you like our work, you can support our work on the funding platform Patreon for the miserly price of a coffee. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. When plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men in a society, over the course of time, they create for themselves a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it, wrote Frédéric Bastiat. This is why it is important to begin to understand organized crime in a wider political and social context. It may be merely the criminal expression of political currents all too prevalent right now in many areas of our life. This is Alex Andreu in the Bunker saying over and out.
The Bunker was presented by Alex Andreu. Production by Kasia Tomashevich. Lead producer is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. Audio productions by me, Robin Lieber. And the theme tune is by Kenny Dickens. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.